I often get asked to use a retroactive effective date or a specific effective date when we're drafting these agreements. And what I'd like to highlight for you here is that, first of all, there is Texas case law supporting the idea that you can use a specific effective date as long as it's not to the detriment of a third party or designed to be to the detriment of a third party. One thing that you have to watch out for if you're doing retroactive effective dates, say, for example, picking January 1st, like a lot of people try to do to match their tax year, you know, you may have records that post-date that from the operation of the company, especially if the parties wait well into the year to do this transaction. And if that's the case, you know, I don't think anyone's really clear on what happens if you say that the partner or member was bought out effective January 1st, but they signed consents and resolutions or other similar documents in, say, for example, July of that year. I did include some sample language in the provided agreement that maybe tries to address that, but it's not litigation tested. Just food for thought to watch out for when you use retroactive effective dates. From a tax perspective, if the entity is taxed as a partnership, it is there appears to be some support for doing retroactive dates in the Internal Revenue Code. Those are referenced in the article. Generally speaking, you can make changes up until the partnership return is filed. There's also a couple of memorandum opinions from the U.S. Tax Court speaking to retroactive effective dates for tax purposes. And basically, as long as they are okay under state law, which we've already identified that there's Texas case law in support, it's not done to get an unwarranted tax benefit, and it's more or less memorializing a prior agreement of the parties that wasn't then reduced to writing. The IRS, at least there is some precedent showing that the IRS would accept a retroactive effective date. The only thing to watch out for there is, you know, the what constitutes an unwarranted tax benefit can vary depending on the circumstances. You know, if you're trying to do a retroactive allocation of substantial losses, I mean, that may be subject to a different level of scrutiny. Okay, another basic clause that we tend to kind of copy and paste from one agreement to the next is your consideration. And this is obviously critical in every agreement. And I focused on it in the article in here just to say, you know, spend some time thinking about, especially in this environment where we have all these creative methods of payment, you know, what you want to clarify as far as how payment is completed, when it's done, what's considered timely payment. And then, I mean, if you're using alternative forms of payment like cryptocurrency, et cetera, be very specific about, you know, valuation and how that works. Covered in more detail in the article. Key takeaways here for those of you that are listening is, if you're using assets to satisfy the consideration or delivery consideration, I always include a disclaimer of warranties associated with that asset when I'm trying to protect the buyer. If it's real estate, then you might want to look at a waiver of Texas property code disclosures if it could possibly be considered residential. If it's commercial property, you know, or residential, you certainly want to make sure that it's transferred as is and draft your disclaimers accordingly. If you have to, you might consider, you know, allowing for an inspection or a waiver of that inspection. Either way, the general theory or the general idea there is to make sure that you're protecting your buyer by having no backdoor claims in the form of unknown warranties. If you're using a promissory note for consideration, from the buyer's perspective, we don't want any delayed vesting. You know, we want the delivery of that note to satisfy our closing obligation. And I also include in that a requirement or an offset in that promissory note for payments or principal if there's a breach of the seller's reps and warranties, or if you know, there is some sum that the seller owes to the buyer. If you've got post-closing obligations and it's a cash deal, one thing you might want to think about is whether you would benefit from an escrow, which is basically holding back a portion of the sale price. The escrow might also be helpful if you're doing post-closing price adjustments. I say this in the article, I'm not a big fan of post-closing price adjustments simply because I think that's like a guarantee of future legal fees. But if you're going to do them, then obviously specificity is the key, and trying to use targets that leave little room for interpretation are better than wide open language that allows for the parties to argue later over what the additional payment should be. All right. If you are using debt assumption as part of the consideration, one other thing I would point out is it's preferable to have those pre-cleared prior to closing, but if you can't get it done pre-closing, then at a minimum, give your client some time to satisfy that issue with a performance window.